Good morning, and thank you very much, Ron. It's a pleasure to me to introduce you to the general principles of electron microscope tomography, or short, electron tomography. I would like to give you first an introduction into the technique and some of the principles, how the tomography works, and then give you lots of, hopefully, interesting examples on what's the virtue, what can it do for us and for the biological sciences especially. Why do we need tomography? This micrograph, electron micrograph, shows you a great detail of structure. You see the Golgi stack, the mitochondria, the nuclear envelope with nuclear pores. However, what it can tell you is the three-dimensional relationship, the connectivity of the structures. How do the cisternae interact maybe with the ER, for example? And even if you do, even if skilled electron microtomists, sectioning thin sections about 40 nanometer thin S, this is going to be the resolution limit for three dimensions that these people in serial thin section microscopy can get. So everything that's high resolution of a few nanometers to 20 nanometers, you do need electron tomography to resolve the three-dimensional connectivity and to see, to determine the three-dimensional structure of pleomorphic, for example, organelles or macromolecules. And that's why we need the technique. And how does it work? It's a technique to obtain three-dimensional information of an object using transmission electron microscopy. And it works very likely the getting a CT of your brain, for example, in the hospital, just in a smaller range. So you have a three-dimensional object, and the electron beam will produce a two-dimensional projection of it. If you tilt the three-dimensional object in relationship to the beam, you can record a set of projections, all viewed from a different angle. And just to illustrate this on one picture, this is Wolfgang Goethe, and if this is the electron beam producing a projection of this image, and if you rotate Goethe, we can get a whole set of projections down here. Let me where's my mouse? Run this again. Here you see the electron densities, kind of this image. The set of projections can then used in the computer, align them, and then back project them into a common volume where all these densities will meet and reconstruct the three-dimensional object in this common volume. Going back to our example of Goethe, that's how it would look like if you had a 180-degree tilt series of Goethe's photo and then reconstruct this in the computer. And if you compare this to the original image, we get a fairly good reconstruction of the original image with some artifacts that are due to, for example, sampling rates, so you have to tilt in discrete angles. But in principle, you can really nicely reconstruct all the structures. The second important part is, except for the imaging technique, for electron microscopy, you have to prepare your specimen because you're going to put the biological specimen into a vacuum, into a high-energy electron beam. And most of you are familiar with the different techniques that are used to preserve the structure and get a good resolution of specimen. And these are the three most common ones used. The one I call conventional one, where at room temperature or on ice, you have chemical fixation, dehydration, embedding in resin, and then staining and sectioning. It then has been realized that this is introducing artifacts into the specimen and more commonly now use the cryo-immobilization. I like to call it immobilization because you really don't use, it's not cryo-fixation unless you use fixation at the moment. So if you go to cryo-immobilization, you cool down your specimen with a very high cooling rate to transfer the water from the liquid state into an amorphous ice or called also solid water because it's still disarranged and randomly arranged water molecules instead of having crystals. So what we really do is we immobilize the particles and structures in the sample by freezing them very fast. We don't fix them yet. The penetration thickness of the freezing, you heard a lot about the techniques, freezing techniques already. The plunge freezing, for example, will be 10 micrometers in thickness. You can get higher penetration of good samples, of good freezing, if you use high-pressure freezing. And So for example, if you probably heard about the plunge freezing technique and the high pressure freezing, I just want to go very shortly. You plunge freeze the grit into liquid ethane and get a very thin ice layer, or in electron tomography we would use little thicker ones up to 250 nanometer, 500 nanometers maximum. Unfortunately, most cells don't, like especially the eukaryotic cells, don't give us the advantage of having, being thin enough to go directly into the microscope with these samples unless we isolate organelles or macromolecules. So this is where the high-pressure freezing comes into, where we have thicker cells and or tissues that we can freeze with the high-pressure freezer. And by applying a pressure of about 2,000 bar just before freezing the sample, we can slow down the growth of crystals and therefore get a better penetration of freezing, good freezing. So what you see here are the hats used for high-pressure freezer, and this is just an example that involves this high-pressure freezer. And then from the immobilized, cryo-immobilized specimen, one route that can be used, which is a very nice compromise for structure preservation and staining, is the so-called pre-substitution technique, where you dehydrate a specimen at low temperatures of about minus 90 degrees Celsius, and then slowly increase the temperature, also embedding in different resins and stain and section it as usual, and then can use the plastic sections in the electron microscope as usual and do the tomography. Another field that's my specialty in Boulder is cryo-electron microscopy, where you take the frozen hydrated sample directly into the electron microscope and image it at low dose conditions. So the advantage of electron tomography is that you retrieve the three-dimensional information of the object in a non-invasive manner, which means you don't have to actually physically section into the specimen by serial sectioning. That it has been shown that you can get resolutions better than 10 nanometer in that dimensions, and that it's applicable to many specimens, and I will show a slide later what really is applicable to, what's a good suitable specimen for electron tomography. Sounds very good. Of course, we also have limitations, and one of the most important limitations is the so-called missing wedge. It's due to that we are limited in the tilt angle range by the specimen. It's the geometry of the specimen holder itself, that at higher angles above 80 degrees, it will shadow on the cover of the specimen itself. And also, if you think of a planar specimen, if you tilt very high, you get endless thick specimen, which you cannot penetrate with electrons. So you're limited to about 70 degree tilt angle in each direction, which means you're missing about 40 degree of coverage of the 180 degree, which will result then in missing information in the Fourier space and the missing wedge. To show this also an example, the reconstruction I showed you from Goethe was done with a plus minus 90 degree tilt series. However, more realistic would be a tilt series of probably plus minus 60 degree increments. Tilt angle range, and you can see that some structures are fairly good reconstructed, like for example the nose or the collar here, but other structures like the eyeballs, the mouse, the information is missing, so you cannot reconstruct it. One way to overcome this problem is to use an approach called the dual axis tilting and reconstruction. John Maddock from Queensland University was so nice to donate this portrait of him. He was very smart because he had this plaid shirt, which is very good to demonstrate the virtue of this double tilting. So again, I made this, the movies, this is the first tilt axis, and this is the reconstruction of the tilt axis, and this is the tilt axis, or the reconstruction done after we rotated the specimen in the microscope at 90 degrees, and then did another tilt series with the axis perpendicular to the first one. And if you look at the two reconstructions, you can see that they look pretty different. Here, for example, if you look at the plate shirt, you see that the structures along the longitudinal here are very nice reconstructed, whereas those that are running horizontally are missing, whereas the other tilt series reveals exactly those structures. So if we now go and combine these two reconstructions, we can see that we can reconstruct the whole information here by combining them. This is, of course, a very simplified and idealized example in 2D In 3D, it's not that perfect. You cannot really perfectly reconstruct it, because if you think of a missing wedge in the Fourier space, which covers the 40 degree, we can't sample. Can you take a second tilt series perpendicular tilt axis in the you rotate the specimen 90 degrees and then overlap these two missing wedges, you still end up having a missing pyramid, the two wedges. And that's where we end up. We're still going to have, with the dual axis reconstruction, a missing pyramid in the Fourier space. And this shows you a setup for Boulder, what we do electron tomography. Traditionally, the high voltage microscope was used. Now we have two TechKnife microscopes. And the one used for tomography most is this F30, operated at 300 kV voltage. The intermediate voltage microscopes turn out in the recent years as advantageous for tomography, just because for tomography you want to have thick samples, and thus you need a high voltage to be able to penetrate these with a good signal-to-noise ratio, these specimens. For the acquisition of the tilt series, we use a software written by David Mastronardi, who will also be in the tomography session, called Cyril-EM, which runs on TechKnife. And typical tilt series, either a single axis if we're talking about cryo, or double tilt axis tilt series for the plastic sections, ranging plus minus 60 or plus minus 70 degree, and an increment of 1 to 1.5 increments. The projections are then aligned, most of the times using colloidal gold as pseudotools, or if you can't deal with this, and this is in a case of, for example, cryo sections where we have problems to get the pseudotools on the section, then we're using cross-correlation methods. Both ways are used in the field of tomography. And the reconstruction we do is using the weighted back projection, and the program we use is IMOD, or the new GUI, the new graphic user interface called the eTomo software, to do the tomographic reconstruction. So in the following, I would like to give you some examples of what have been done already. The first part will be from plastic thick sections, and then the second a little bit of cryo. What you see here from Mary Morphew and David Mastronardi is a 250 nanometer, the projection of a 250 nanometer thick section, plastic section. It was from a mammalian PTK cell. It shows you the mitotic spindle. It was high pressure frozen and then pre-substituted and imaged at the high voltage microscope. Here you see the pair of centriole bundles of microtubules attaching here to the C chromosomes. And then here the structure would be the so-called kinetochore, which is a protein mass that is at the boundary of the chromosomes in a specialized region of the chromosome called the centromere to facilitate the attachment of the microtubules to the chromosomes so they can be pulled to the poles in the mitosis. This one shows you the first axis of a tilt series. Here would be the mass of the chromosome, and then here you see sometimes in the projection the microtubules. All these little dots here are the fiducial markers that we use, and they are applied to both sides of the plastic section, so we can use them to compute some distortion corrections if necessary. This one shows you and both is true, because for the free substitution, this one was done with uranyl acetate and osmium, the free substitution at low temperatures, and then the section was post-stained with uranyl acetate and lead citrate. The lead citrate tends to have some surface staining, yes. I think you still get penetration into it, but it tends to participate at the section surface, which you can't see in the reconstruction because you can slice through and you see very nicely that you get stain up to the surface. And the next movie shows you the reconstruction already of the combined tomogram. Here's the chromosome mass again. You see the microtubules in a very good signal-noise ratio. And if you go to a XY slice of this reconstruction, we can look at the microtubules, and these are the plus ends attaching to the chromosome, and it turned out with this study that most of the ants are flared, which is was a surprise because flared ants are associated with disassembling of microtubules. However, they imaged Marimorphia mesonati, they imaged both sides of it, of crystal kinetochores, and both sides turned out to have most of the kinetochore microtubules had flared ends. Though you know that the movement of the chromosomes is forth and back, and it's not possible that both disassemble at the same time. So this is a puzzling and it's still an ongoing study. The next example I would like to talk about is the basal body and centriole assembly in Chlamydomonas, done by Eileen O'Toole in collaboration with Susan Dutcher and Tom Giddings. Here you see the unicellular algae Chlamydomonas, the chloroplast, the nucleus, and here the two flagella with the basal body where it's anchored in the cell. And this schematic from Rango, published 1967, shows you something he deducted from serial thin sections. This one here, the two flagella, the basal bodies, they are anchored with the distal serrated fibers. You will find four rootlet fibers to anchor it. And if you look to the cross-section from here's distal, and this will be proximal, you see that the basal body area is a highly polar structure. So if you go from the proximal area, we have the three microtubules blades that form this pinwheel. And if you then go up in the so-called transitional zone, which is this area here that looks like an H shape, you'll see that the blades have transitional fibers projecting to the periphery here. And then going further on, these are the stellar fibers until you come and reach the place where you see the very classical nine doublet plus two microtubules in the center structure. Do you think, well, looks very soft. You see a serious section tomogram covering 700 nanometers, so it's three consecutive 250 nanometer sections, covering this cross-section of a basal body. And here you see the stellate fibers, the microtubule doublets, the transitional fibers, the blades of three microtubules here. And then in the most proximal one, you see also the longitudinal, the perpendicular-oriented longitudinal section of the basal body. So you think, well, a nice corroboration of the structure, good preservation. But what is the new thing here? And the new thing comes here, because if you look at this, this is a gallery of XY slices to a part, the transitional zone of the basal body. And these are the images 5 and 6 described by the stellar, by Ringo, showing the stellar fibers here, first with a little density ring, and then without the ring, but again, the stellar fibers. But it turns out, if you have a better resolution, and he just couldn't do this because you don't have the resolution of 10 nanometer when you do serious section reconstruction, it turns out between these two stellar fibers, there's an area where you don't have the fibers and you have a amorphous disk of material. It's unknown what it is, but it's shown for the first time using tomography here. And then this study also went on doing some investigation on mutants. Dutcher and Tobacco showed that the UniG gene encodes the delta tubulin, which was identified to be one part, the fourth tubulin in the tubulin subfamily. And there is a deletion mutant, UniG3, and these cells, they found assembled no one or two flagella, excuse me. And the first electron microscopic observations of the serious section, thin sections, they showed, they deducted that most of the basal bodies showed doublets rather than triplet microtubules. So here comes the study done by Eileen O'Toole, and first of all, it shows it's wrong. They still have triplets in, which means the deduction that the unigene, that the third, the C tubule in this triplet is made up by delta tubulin is wrong, because the delta tubulin is missing here, and you still find three microtubules in here. What actually turned out to be true is that we have an ectopic assembly, which means you assemble structures in the wrong place. The typical place for the transitional zone would be where the flagellum leaves the cell, so in this height, and this one, just to show you where we are, this is a gallery of XY sections in cross-section, and we are going from proximal to distal here, and this is the same one, just sectioned in longitudinal section. And here you can see, so we're not having several different ones, but this is the same basal body or flagellum we're looking at here, and you can see that transitional zone is not only built where it's supposed to be built, this H-shaped structure tells you where it is, in this region, but it's also built in a different, in a wrong position. So this mutant could be described in a totally new way. With serial section, they missed the point that these two times the last fiber showing up in a serial section actually means that you have assembly in wrong places. So electron tomography has the problem that there's no real like a fixed formula to calculate the resolution. So people normally, if we see, for example, the leaflets of the membrane, then we have about 5 nanometer resolution, and that's actually what you get in these fixation. And the stain is the limiting factor for plastic section tomography, whereas in cryo, it's a different thing. The limiting factor for cryo electron tomography is that you have to apply very few doses, and you know this being here in the cryo workshop, so you don't get radiation damage of the specimen, and the low dose is the one giving you bad signal-to-noise ratio, and that's this is the limiting factor for the cryo. But here in the stain specimen, the stain itself, and it's thought to be about 5 nanometer resolution. Excuse me? The total dose is pretty high. I actually don't know for this specimen, but for plastic section, it's about a factor of 100 higher than for cryotomograms, and for cryo, it would be about 10,000 electrons per nanometer squared, so you get a factor of 100 higher. But this is really varying, depends on the section, the thickness of the section, for example. For plastic section, it's that you get initial collapse of the specimen that's known. It could be about 40%, and it's on the curve, and you want to be on the curve that it flattens out. You don't want to have shrinkage while you're taking the tilt series. So you normally accept and know that you have the shrinkage in the thickness of the plastic section, and you just accept it and either correct for it or just say that you have it. But except for that, you don't have much radiation damage unless you get stain precipitation, for example. That's one of the artifacts you can get with high dose. But dose is really not the limiting factor. Is there another question? That is the straight, well, it's a weighted back projection. It's not the R-rated one, so you get the thicknesses used to be, make an exact weighting of it. However, the no, it's not low-pass filter, it's not denoised or anything. It's, I mean, in the tomographic reconstruction, there is a filter cutoff that you can set yourself, and I don't know which one it was here, but it's not the filter itself that makes it less clear. The reason the Boulder Laboratory has a very high history of improving techniques, especially preparation techniques. So this, I know for specialty, was used in high urine acetate and very low osmium, if at all. And so they did a lot of investigation improvements on the, for each specimen to improve the preparation. So I know that Eileen used very few stain, which makes it more clear, I think, in this case.
The point that's not just great.
Another example from our lab done by Brad Marsh in collaboration with Catherine Howe is studying insulin-producing cells, the pancreatic beta cells of mouse. And what you see here is covering a very huge area of a cell, giving you the possibility to see a lot of connectivity of this. In this case, what he's investigating is the complex structure of the Golgi. And you see this will be the trans and the cis side of the Golgi. It's kind of wrapping around the corner here. And you can imagine, well, so you see mitochondria here, and then this is standing, for example. And you can follow this, but just following these serial sections, which each of them were, I think, 400 nanometer thick, so you're covering here actually 1.2 micrometer thickness of a cell. And a big panel to covering a big cube of the cell. And then, but if you look and zoom through it, it's really difficult to analyze what is connected to what. So what you need is to visualize it and to model this. And this is using the IMED software program. You can model these cisternae, and you can see what is connected to what. Here was the yellow one. So you follow them through the stacks, model them, and what you end up having is the famous model of this beta cell here, showing the Golgi apparatus. And then you can dissect them by looking only at the mitochondria, looking only at the cisternae, the transcyte, the cystite, looking at microtubules connecting things, at the vesicles. You can analyze and quantify a lot of structures in here. So it's a huge amount of information covered here. And that's the virtue of tomography. This one shows you also something that was developed in the Boulder lab, which is montaging. This one was done at the F30 microscope, and it's a 2K by 2K camera. And each of these quadruples here shows you one of the camera panels. And then by tilting the beam, you can, by image shifting, you can take different panels next to each other and then combine them again into these sections and get a huge panel of reconstruction. It is done also by 3x panel adding, for example. And then the second one just shows you the perpendicular tilt axis again. So this is an example, again, of a Golgi apparatus, what is possible in kind of big reconstructions. So now coming to the cryo-electron tomography. And so we had this, remember this chart we had before. And I'm talking about after cryomobilization, we go to cryo-electron tomography, where we cover here two different things. You either have the plunge frozen specimen that are thin enough anyway, could be isolated microtubules, could be isolated organelles, or cells that are thin enough on their own, bacteria, or parts of cells like lamellipods of dictyostelium, for example, the growth cone of neurons, or flagella, which I will show an example of. On the other hand, most of eukaryotic cells are too thick to do this, so we use the hyperbaric freezing, and then you have the cryosection, which is a tricky technique. It's difficult because the ice doesn't section as nice as plastic does. It's more brittle, and you may introduce a lot of artifacts by just sectioning them. Dr. Boucher in Switzerland has a 20-year history of improving this technique, for example. I think several labs are now able to do this technique, and though that you're living with some artifacts that I'll show you later a little bit, I think that we can overcome these artifacts and still have, in a small range, very nice reconstructions of cryosections. So the first example would cover the first part where I plunge freeze my specimen and then directly go into the electron microscope. What you see here is a project I'm still working on. It's sea urchin sperm flagella, and this shows you a low mag of a grid. This would be the copper bar, and then you have 24, which is a holy carbon film. Each of these holes is 2 micrometer in diameter, and you see this is the sperm head and the tail. I do no preparation at all. I make the sea urchin spore and then apply the sperm directly, plunge freeze them. That has no preparation at all involved, which means I'm having the best chance to not introduce any artifacts but get the lifelike preserved state here. The next movie shows you one of the tilt series I recorded. This would be the edge of the carbon film. This would be only free ice layer with this exonine of this flagellum spanning this hole here. It was an activated one. And these little dots are the gold fiducials. You see a striation of the exoneme, the microtubules that make up this exoneme. However, you cannot really resolve the each of the microtubules on its own, or even one of the particles. But here in the reconstruction, you see great details, like the microtubule doublets here. Each one is resolved. You even see particles that are between them in the center part, for example, radio spokes. You see between, if you look here, you see the black dots between the microtubules, which are the autodynein arms. And I have a stills of these tomograms. So this one was a cryosynth flagellum. The virtue of tomography, we can just rotate the the volume we reconstructed and look at the cross-section. So you see the 9 microtubule doublets and the 2 center ones. This is a central slice, the peripheral microtubule with the radial spoke projecting to the center part. Here on the activated one, this one was slightly compressed. We don't have for the activated one and not compressed one yet, but this one shows that it will be possible. It's just tricky to get the right specimen thickness here. But what you see, for example, here in this peripheral slice, longitudinal one, you see the microtubule doublet, and these little black dots are the densities of the autodynein arms. This is a visualization of it. It's slightly denoised before we applied objective surface rendering, so we did not model this specific one. The signal noise ratio was good enough. So you see in brown the plasma membrane, the microtubule doublets, the radial spokes, and here the densities of the dynein arms, the two heads. Even in this case, you see the two heads. The reason why things sometimes are not connected is, again, the missing wedge problem we have. So microtubule information up here at the sides, or here, for example, that's my missing information that I have to live with, unless I average and cover of particles of different orientations in this tomogram, for example. This shows you just, because I don't have the time to go into more detail of this project, shows you what different things. So you saw the visualization in C-dimension. We can average the central pair and look at each of these projections more in close detail. Look at these bipartite bridges. We can analyze the three-dimensional arrangement of the radial spokes. How are they arranged around the axoneme? We're trying to deduct from the structure also functional properties of the flagellum. And here are the first tries to average the autodynein particles out of the tomograms, for example. If I focus your interest first at this longitudinal section, here would be an atrial of a microtubule doublet, the neighboring doublet here, the B-tubule, and then there would be the stalk and one of the two globular halves of the dynein, autodynein arms here. So the amazing thing is we have macromolecular resolution in this tomogram. And by averaging, we can improve averaging similar particles out of the tomograms. We can improve the signal-noise ratio that is the biggest problem in cryotomography and get resolution that's amazingly, of course, we will never reach the single particle resolution where they can average 50,000 particles. However, we can look at dynamic states. We can hopefully sometime analyze the dynein cycle along such a curvature. How does the dynein cycle work in cell, in vitro? And we have the snapshots, but we can look at different points of these snapshots of the dynein cycle. The next and last example is using frozen hydrated sections. I said this is a really ongoing process. The combination, so cryotomography is, it's known for a long time, but the instruments, like in the last 10 years, made it really possible to use this technique in a successful way. But the combination with cryomicrotomy, which is also a challenging technique, is very recently used. The Albany group published one paper on it yet, and I think 3 groups are working on it to make the combination. And Mark Ledinsky in our lab is the one who is improving himself a lot in doing the cryosections. So we're using the high-pressure frozen samples. The top, the domed part, is coated with lecithin, so it will come off in a nice way, and a little dome would stick out of the specimen. And then we're using the Leica UltraCut cryo box, where the temperature, you can adjust it very nicely, and we normally mark pertains to that minus 160 degree, and we're using the 35 degree cryo diamond knife. The sections are cut to about 100 and 200 nanometer thickness. And here would be the copper bar grids again. And you see here one of the sections. It looks pretty rippled, but if you look into the detail down, the macromolecular arrangement is very nice preserved in some areas. This is to show you that you do have contrast, especially membranes have a nice contrast, even in these frozen hydrated samples. You're having here contrast between protein and ice, which is a very low difference, but you still have enough contrast, or lipids in this case of the membranes. And Here in the center would be microtubules and slightly diagonal but almost cross-sectional view. So this would be microtubules here. We're looking here at a fission yeast nucleus in mitosis. So this would be the spindle cross-section here. Just to give you an overview, this is, again, the rim of a quantifor. We're not using quantifors anymore. This is in the hole. You see mitochondria, nice contrast. Here would be the cell wall of the fission yeast, the plasma membrane, and then below the plasma membrane we find very often the ER, and each of these most of the particles here is a very high ribosome content here. To go a little bit into the artifacts you're dealing with, you have a compression of about 40% along the direction of cutting. There are techniques, Sunny Schuler, for example, is working on a vibrating knife that might get rid of this artifact of compression. There's a thumb rule. The angle of the knife, meaning here 35-degree cryo-knife, plus the free angle you're using for the technique itself gives you about the percentage of compression you will get. You will end up with this normal diamond knife. So having 40 about. Another artifact are these crevasses, these little cracks, and they come because when you section, the section itself is tilted away, so you get micro compression on the side where it curls to or it's bent to. So these are micro compressions, these crevasses here. And I think, no, it doesn't, so I don't have the image in here because it's not a special cryo. It turns out the crevasses extend about one third in depth of the section itself, which is a great news because it means two-thirds is unperturbed. So we can look at two-thirds of them and we don't see cracks, two-thirds of the thickness of the specimen, of the section itself. Yeah, two-thirds is without crevasses. Oh, about 100 to 200 nanometer thick sections. To show you that, though, of course, we're still having problems and we're still working on improving this technique, we already can use it to solve biological problems, to look at biology and forget a little bit about the technique. You know, you want to apply the technique at one time. And what I show you here is the mitotic cycle of a fission yeast cell. The nuclear envelope does not appear in the cells. You get kind of a metaphase plate, then the chromosomes are pulled to the poles, and you get a tube-shaped nuclear envelope when the anaphase B starts, and you get the elongation of the spindle. And we have a tomogram. The next tomogram will be showing you a part of this spindle midzone area where the microtubules overlap. This one is the tomogram. It's very barely visible. Here you can see the tube of the nuclear envelope with the microtubules cross-sectioned in here. Here's a better view of the microtubules in the spindle midzone, and you can model this and see that some of the microtubules, this one for example, this is the end of the section, so you have to live with it. But this ends in the section on this side, and this one ends in the other. So we're having microtubules coming from both sides and ending inside the section. In blue is the nuclear envelope. And we found that the distance is very regular between these microtubules from center to center. And we found kind of a square arrangement. So we looked in if we see anything between these microtubules. And again, this is a cross-sectional view, nuclear envelope, microtubule cross-section. And again, the virtue, we can tilt this volume upside down and look at the longitudinal section just to show you where we are. Nuclear envelope modeled here and here. And we found that between the microtubules, we find density that in the cross-section is, let me see if I get this back and forth. There we go. So we find density in between here, which is barely visible. But if you go to the cross section, to the longitudinal section one, you can see the same bridges, and they're arranged in unidistinal. So this will be the next one. And then over here, you find more. Let me see, where is it? Here, there's another one of these bridges. So this connectivity between, or this connection between the microtubules has not been described before. So we don't have like the most beautiful resolution here, the best signal-noise ratio. We discovered new structure in between because we can slice it in a very miniature section and then look at each, let's say, 2 nanometer slice of this and analyze it. It also turns out we just compared the cross-section and the plastic one, which was published by Wu Baiding. And not really surprisingly, we found that we have a slightly different measurements. So the plastic does shrink a little bit. The microtubule diameter, for example, is measured to about 24 nanometer, whereas we measured in cryo 25 nanometer, which is also corroborated by in vitro studies, cryo in vitro studies of microtubules. And then the same counts also for the center-to-center distance of the microtubules. A little bit about the future directions of electron tomography in general. How can we get resolution better than 5 nanometer? And this is just an kind of a brainstorm of ideas. There are plenty more ideas out there, I'm pretty sure. Just to give you an overview, concerning high-pressure frozen free-substituted and then plastic embedded specimen, as I said, the stain and the preservation by the preparation is the limiting factor here. So improved preservation, better staining, using, for example, hydrophilic resins to get a better, maybe, immunolabeling, for example. All this is in progress and still be worked on. Concerning cryo-electron tomography, one of the major things that already brought a big advantage is the energy filtering. It filters out all the inelastically scattered electrons, which blur you the image, and thus gives you a better contrast of the low contrast inherently in the eye specimen. Then the radiation, reduced radiation damage would be a nice thing. We're trying to do this by more intelligent acquisition softwares. We're using low-dose acquisition, which means only at the record itself is done at the specimen. Tracking, focusing is done on a different specimen. Then using the intermediate voltage and the field emission gun, the helium-cooled might give us an advantage sometime, and or might be shown to be adventurous. The CCD cameras are going to be improved. People work on, Gattaz, for example, works on a improved lens-coupled camera. This also plays into a noise reduction, and something that's already done for plastic section might be adventurous also for the cryo. Gattaz also works, for example, on a double tilt cryo holder. Higher tilt increments would be adventurous. Something that accounts for both techniques, cryo and plastic section tomography. Because the resolution is around 5, to really go forward to identify molecular machines in the cell, connectivity between machines, you will need specific molecular labels in the cell. Or to find, for example, a spindle, you need GFP labels, and you have to visualize this in EM. That's the problem. At the moment, for light microscopy, the tools of molecular biology can be applied in a very nice way. GFP is universally applied. It's again a great advantage, all the labeling. At the moment, we're suffering of having a nice transfer to immunolabeling, a specific labeling of molecules that can be transferred to EM visible specimen. So there's a lot of groups work on different approaches on this way. And then last but not least, improvement in image processing is a very big thing. Starting from denoising, from improved reconstruction methods, you can, for example, reconstruct and then go backwards with the reconstruction and then iteratively improve, for example, something that's done for two-dimensional analysis all the time. We should use these techniques and improve the reconstruction itself in different ways. Segmentation will be something to be able to cover all these huge reconstructions to really analyze the huge amount of information in these reconstructions. Finally, I would like to thank the people that contributed to this talk, Mary Morphew and David Mastronati from the Kinetical Project, Alino O'Toole, Susan Dutcher, and Tom Giddings for the Basal Body Project, Brad Marsh in collaboration with Stefan Howe from the Health Science Center for the pancreatic beta cell study, and then the cryo-electron tomography in our lab done by Cindy Schwartz, Mark Lewinsky, Mary Morphew, and David Mastronati, and of course, our PI, Dick McIntosh. Thank you very much for your attention. Linda. Because the cryo section has, so for plunge freezing I still use the quantifoil. The cryo section has a trouble that they're too crinkly, they waved. So we found out that one of the ideas to have fiducial markers for better reconstruction and helping us reconstruct in a better way, because cross-correlation works pretty good for stained. It doesn't very good work for the low contrast in ice. So that's, we would like to have a fiducial reconstruction. The problem is, so we thought we just apply the fiducial on the carbon film, put the section on, you stamp them kind of on, and then just use them even if they're not directly applied to the section. But it turns out these sections are so wrinkly and wavy, they're away up to 30 micron away, which means you have a tilt series where the hole, including the hole of the quantifoil, for example, would wave by like this. Like, you know, you have your centricity on your specimen, and then the carbon foil waves by like this. That's the reason why I didn't show you the tilt series, because you get really dizzy looking at it. So that's the reason why we went to having no structure in the film itself, so we're having just plain carbon-coated grids at the moment for the plastic, for the cryo section. Both. I think the high pressure freezer is something you can not as easily build yourself. So the high pressure freezer is kind of a given state you need. You need the high pressure freezer to get the samples at the first step in a good preserved state. I think that's the important one. The free substitution, actually, I have seen custom made ones that don't look that expensive. I think you can fiddle around, you can make these things happen. Yeah. Some of them, you know, the most easiest one would be a styrofoam box cooled with dry ice with a little, you know, keeping temperature. So that would be very easy approaches. I mean, you want, of course, the nicest, most convenient one. But I think on this place, I think that improving the technique on preparation is the one you can, yourself, can still improve most, because it's not worked out. Everyone does it different. And everything else, you know, always different methods work for different specimens. So this is something you personally can work on the best, I think. You can improve the most, but it will also be the most time-consuming to improve things. High pressure freezing is something I would give as a given state. So to more quantitatively compare the different techniques that are used, most of them were used in a way of visually inspecting most of the time. But they just started exploring techniques like diffraction and so on to quantify the differences in preservation. But there's no paper out yet on this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that I might have mixed up the terminology sometimes in between. So the actual 2D projection set is called a tilt series, and the software involved here is CODEM, a automatic acquisition program for the microscope itself, written by David Massonari. Then you have the three-dimensional reconstruction called the tomogram, which is the volume itself, which was reconstructed using the iMod software, and a new graphical interface for the iMod, which is called the eTomo. So it's just a GUI for the iMod on top of the iMod. Also done in the Boulder Lab with David Massonari on the iMod part and Rick Goddard on the eTomo. And then for visualizing, so there's one thing that, for example, in Brad's data I showed was you model it and then the manually modeled surfaces are visualized using the iMod software. In the case of my cryotomographs of the exonym, there was a slightly denoising using Baumeister's denoising anisotropic diffusion program, and then objective surface rendering using the Amira software package for the surface rendering of the volume. The reconstruction, yes. Yes. Yeah. In a way, we're trying this. So the first thing is, tomography is used most of the time for pleomorphic structures that you cannot easily average on themselves. So this is the virtue of the technique and bridging different techniques. High-resolution techniques such as the two-dimensional reconstruction, where you have 50,000 same particles that you can average easily, or not easily, but average. And so you're looking at pleomorphic structures. So it's not easy to make a tomogram of a mitochondrium and average it of another mitochondrium with a different missing batch. However, in the project, for example, of the axoneme, of the flagellum has a great amount of repetitive particles inside. And one of the approaches is to cut out the particles and using the approach that was developed for two-dimensional reconstruction of 2D images, align them, and then it's true. If you have different orientations of particles in the tomogram in relation to the tilt axis, and you average in a good way and weight it, in the ideal case, you should get rid of the artifact of missing mesh. That's an idea we would like to pursue, but it's tricky. For example, you can imagine having a low contrast particle, noisy one, and you have to align it. It tends to align at the missing mesh, actually. So you have aligning problems before. So we're having computing problems fulfilling the goal at the moment. It doesn't mean we're going to stop there. We will hopefully get some time at the point where we can get rid of this artifact. Good point. To prevent charging? I think that the problems we have with tomography are much greater than the problem we have with charging. So for the so for the tomography, the resolution is not good enough that we really worry about charging. I think it's much more difficult in the case of taking low-dose, high-resolution images of particles, for example, where Fujiyoshi is one of the, I think, one of the ones that developed a lot of techniques to, like, pre-expose the carbon for a whole night in the electron microscope to get rid of charging the next day, for example. There's nothing of these tricks and techniques we're using. No. I have not had access to a helium temperature microscope, but I think there are at least two groups working on tomographic data. I really don't know. From conferences, I can tell you that people say that the frequencies in the mid-range, so the high frequencies are better preserved, maybe. You get less dose radiation damage in the specimen, preserving the high frequencies longer. Whereas the mid-range of frequencies, the contrast is decreased. So the problem I see for tomography is we actually work a lot with these mid-frequencies. We don't work that much with the high-resolution frequencies. So it might be a trouble, actually, having the contrast in this mid-area frequencies reduced. But this is just an... That's true. Well, if it's true that the compute stage is more stable, that would be great. So I don't know the answer to the question of helium. I don't know. No insights from Bama Sekou, sorry. I'm not sure if I got the question right. Yes, that's true. So the higher angles, and it's not easy to get to higher angles as I try to emphasize that. Because, for example, with the cosinus getting up at 6 degrees, you will have the double thickness as before, which means you get you either increase the dose or you get less dose on the image, less counts on the images on the CCD itself. Getting even higher, maybe the architecture of the sensor itself can help us here. So there are ideas to go to different geometry of the specimen itself. Just think of, instead of having a thick plastic section that goes up to high 90 degree, you're just unable to go through. I don't know how big these things are, a millimeter up to, I guess, in size. Just imagine having cubes or rectangles that would tilt, and just the square root of the diameter would be the limiting, the thickest you get. So there are different things you can still work on. It's not going to be universally applicable. So the tilt angle will always be a limiting factor. I think you're longer ahead. How do we evaluate the results? So we do not apply CTF correction. Let's start with the plastic section. The resolution is limited to about 5 nanometer by the stain limiting factor. So CTF correction will not have a big influence here because we are imaging close to focus. Going to the cryo samples, because we can't work here with the amplitude contrast as much, the contrast is so low, we're employing the technique of phase contrast mostly. Having a high defocus and increasing the contrast by this way, which means we are going in defocus. It's always going to be a compromise. You decide what do I want to reach? What is more important, the contrast? Is it more important that, for example, in the exonine, I know I will be able to average afterwards and possibly get a better resolution. So I rather go a little closer to the focus than with the tomograms. I know it's going to be a pleomorphic, unique structure. Important here is getting a resolution of maybe 6 nanometer and have it in a good contrast and visualize this. So we can talk about defocus at the 300 kV instrument, somewhere around minus 10 micrometer. However, still with 10 micrometer, the first zero is somewhere around 4 to 5 nanometer. It's still at a place where it's not going to be relevant for, at the moment at least, for a CTF correction or giving us a better effect. This first one. The second one is how I evaluate the data, the results. It's depending on your biological problem, whatever you look at. It's visual. The brain is a very good processor of three-dimensional data when they move, for example. So we look very long at the movies, at the tomograms. IMOD has very nice tools to analyze things. They have slicer, you can rotate things and all different angles. We visualize them, volume rendering, surface rendering, and we try. The IMOD program has nice tools also to quantify. So you model, for example, microtubules. IMINO2 modeled, I don't know, several thousand microtubules in spindles, for example, of C. elegans. And the program then can try to get statistics out of it. Do microtubules approach in a special angle? Do they approach in different distances? Is there, you know, analyzing all different layers, actually. Is this answering your question? I don't know. Did you present the Clarin? Let me get this.